Tonight on The Download, former NBC and MTV news correspondent Allison Stewart, Chicago author Michelle Wooker, and live music from Old Town School of Folk Music's Bill Bricky. And now here's your host, a man who has eaten Sloppy Joe's for 4 days straight, Justin Kaufman.
So tangy, so miserable.
But I gotta keep going. I got another day. You know, if I want to get value out of my Sloppy Joe. Remind me again why I got the slow cooker, the crock pot, because I made some Sloppy Joe on Monday, and I've been eating it for pretty much breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the last 4 days. I can't see straight. I just have that Adam Sandler song in my head. Sloppy Joe, sloppy, sloppy Joe. It's pretty crazy. Welcome to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you here till 11 o'clock tonight. What an amazing show we have lined up tonight. I don't know why we're so fortunate, and frankly, I don't know how we're going to fit it all in. So let's get to it. First up tonight, we're going to talk with Jamal Cole. Cole's the man behind My Block, My Hood, My City. It's an organization that takes teenagers to different neighborhoods around Chicago so they get a better understanding of where they live. We'll talk about communities, gun violence, the police, and what it takes to make your neighborhood better. My guest tonight at the big table is the Chicago author. Michelle Wooker's book, The Gray Rhino, is out next week. It's a book that explores the odd human behavior of not acting and or recognizing impending dangers. She looks at financial meltdowns, climate change, and other big ticket issues, and why we just don't take action. I think that's pretty appropriate here in the state of Illinois. Later in the show, junk. We all got it. And journalist Allison Stewart just had to get rid of hers. And that inspired the book Junk, Digging Through America's Love Affair with Stuff. Stewart of NBC, ABC, and MTV News will be coming to Chicago this weekend. And we will have her first right here on The Download. She'll be signing books at the bookseller. And also tonight, stand-up comedian Andy Kindler. Of course, everybody knows Andy Kindler, right? He's a friend of Ray Romano's and Everybody Loves Raymond. You can see him on IFC's Marin, plays Mark Marin's friend. He's all over the place. A New York comedian who now lives in Los Angeles. The big thing he does is at the Just for Last Festival, he delivers the State of the Industry keynote, which has been ongoing for a couple of years now. So we're going to talk to him about his career and get a progress report on the state of the stand-up comedy industry. And in our highbrow segment tonight, the new artistic director of the American Theater Company, Will Davis, will join us to talk about his approach to theater. The New York director is joined by playwright Abe Kugler, whose show Kill Floor is on stage till May 1st. We'll talk about what it takes to put on a play, what has to happen in rehearsal, and sort of talk about the art of the choice. That's what we're going to do with highbrow tonight with Will and Abe. And my old friend and one of the best musicians in town, Bill Bricky, is going to be here. Bill's playing with his band BLT at Hidden Shamrock this weekend. The Old Town School of Folk Music vet's going to bring his guitar for a little live performance, and we're going to talk music. He's actually was telling me that he's back into protest music. He sort of, you know, he did a little deep dive, and so now he's finding himself writing more protest music. So we will talk with Bill Bricky coming up later tonight. All that plus a huge ticket giveaway, Beer Under Glass, one of the hottest parties in town. It's a craft beer jam to raise money for the Garfield Park Conservatory, and tickets just went on sale, and we've got a pair to give away tonight. VIP! That's how we roll here on The Download. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon, and production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, let's get to it. What do you want to do? Oh, I know what we should do. Why don't we do the carryout? That's what we do every night here on The Download. Of course, this is where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Tomorrow, the most elaborate April Fool's joke in the history of April Fool's will take place in Chicago.
See, the teachers' union keeps saying that they're going to walk out to protest the budget crisis and unfair labor practices and proposed pay cuts, but it's April Fool's, so they're just going to be in school.
What? What do you mean? It's real? This is real? Oh, God, I'll be right back. I got to figure out what to do with my kid. All right, he can come to work with me. Governor Rauner today suggested that the planned walkout by the teachers union was an abuse of power. Really? I would probably shy away from grandiose cliches like abuse of power when you're a governor who has no budget. But what do I know? Maybe that's not an abuse of power. Maybe holding up the budget over ideology is... No, that's an abuse of power. To be fair, I think the Democrats and Speaker Madigan are guilty of the same thing. But Madigan, see, he doesn't put his foot in his mouth. He just quietly abuses power. Touche. Which actually is probably worse. Activists are upset that the FOP gave former police officer Jason Van Dyke a job. Van Dyke is awaiting trial and murder charges on the death of Laquan McDonald. All right, can I say something controversial here? They didn't give him a lobbyist job. They didn't give him a consultant job. He doesn't have to wear a suit. He's getting paid $12 an hour to change light bulbs and clean toilets at the FOP headquarters. Would you want that job? I mean, have you seen some of these FOP guys and what they eat? Ugh. Come on, seriously, calm down, everybody. He's going to be in court soon. McDonald's announced today they got plans to expand the brand in Asian markets like Hong Kong. You know, there's a horse meat, dog meat joke in there somewhere. I just don't have enough time to find it. Amazon made moves today to make it easier to buy embarrassing items online. They chose 77 items, which include condoms, Depends, and tampons. Really, tampons? Is it me or are women not really embarrassed to buy tampons? I mean, it's a necessity. I thought we were talking about items like Justin Bieber posters or the gloves you wear to play pool. Those are embarrassing. Tampons? Come on. Scientists say that sea levels could rise 50 feet in 500 years. All right, slow down. You keep throwing your mumbo-jumbo stats and numbers at us, but could you please put it in terms we can understand? I mean, feet, years? What do you think we are, Stephen Hawking? All we want to know is can we keep throwing our trash in the ocean, right? Simple question. In weather, April showers, a day early. Going to get nasty in the next couple hours. In sports, the Hawks go to Winnipeg tomorrow, probably without Duncan Keith, but it's Winnipeg, so I don't even think you need defensemen. Valpo is underway in the NIT Tournament Championship, which I call the NIT. Isn't NIT like a flea shampoo? College basketball, brought to you by Lice Remover. Anyway, Valpo for the win, you hear? Let's do it, 219. Let's go Poe. I even shortened the shorten. You like that? Let's go Poe. That should be on their T-shirts next year. The Bulls are in Houston tonight. Pretty much have to win out and get help to get into the playoffs, you know, so they could be swept in the first round. It's sad when the big story on SportsCenter about your team is about another team chasing your old record. The Warriors are just 5 wins away from breaking the Bulls' 72-10 record. Yeek. The Bears are on a late free agent spending spree, although I'd say it's less of a spree and more of a Saturday morning garage sale tour. Manny Ramirez, Todd Larson, and Omar Boldin come to Chicago. Larson started a ton of games at guard for Arizona, but he's a little bit old now. So it's kind of like finding a vintage lamp or a lightly used big wheel or old 1970s Playboys, the best kind of play. All right, you know what? I'm going to stop. Stop now. You get it. And finally tonight, a West Town teenager has challenged Rahm Emanuel to a duel, a sword fight. Rahm hasn't accepted or denied the challenge, but the sword fight would be on May 31st down by the Bean. I hope Rahm accepts just for the costumes, because you know he'd look super cute, like in a frilly pirate outfit, saying, "On guard!" But you also know that he'd probably go for the kill. I'd be scared, teenager. Really scared. That's the carryout for March 31st, 2016. Hey, tomorrow's April Fool's, so if you get takeout from us, it's gonna be a joke.
Much more to come here on The Download tonight. The author of The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore. Michelle Walker is going to be in studio. She's my guest at the big table. Also, Allison Stewart, Andy Kindler, Bill Bricky, Will Davis, Abe Kugler, and much, much more. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. After last night's interview with Andrew WK, I've decided to wear sunglasses the entire show. The Blackhawks dropped off some choice sunglasses, Rob. I don't know what, if you can
nice.
See them. If you're watching on the webcam, you can see.
They're, like in a 3-inch by 3-inch screen, you look good.
Yeah, and they're Ray-Ban-ish. I wouldn't say they're Ray-Bans, but they're Ray-Ban-ish. Like sort of like a Tom Cruise in Risky Business. Or Cocktail. Or whatever movie he was in.
You're working it.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
I'll probably throw these away. But I was going to say that, you know, coming up after the news, we're going to talk with Allison Stewart about her new book, Junk, Digging Through America's Love Affair with Stuff. How's your basement?
Mine's not too bad.
Yeah.
I'm still working on Mrs. Robb.
Yeah.
She continually likes to bring things into the house without taking things out of the house.
Right.
This is one of our issues. She knows it. I mean, that's the first step. I mean, we've had intervention. We've had meetings. She's getting there.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because Stewart talks right at the top about, you know, it was the situation she had to go into her parents' basement and clean it out after they died. And that's how it starts. And it's just interesting that, like, I started thinking about my parents' basement, my in-laws' basement, my house at home. And I'm like, yeah, there's so much junk. Like, it's not hoarder level.
Right.
But it's just the kind of thing that, like, I don't need to keep the little swing that my son had when he was a baby, you know, the one that's like motorized that you got to replace the batteries on. Very 2006. You know, by the time they get to another baby comes along, you're not going to be able to use those. You know, it'll all be like Bluetooth.
Yeah.
Right? It'll just, like, the baby will move. There won't even be a chair. It'll just be digital.
Well, you know, and I know we've all been down this road, but I get in, you know, from my shift probably about, you know, 1:15 in the morning. And I love nothing more than walking up the steps and hearing the crunch of some toy under my feet.
Yeah, that's no good.
That's awesome.
That's a Lego. I got Lego.
Oh, no. The Legos bring me to my knees.
Yeah.
With those sharp little corners. Well, yeah.
That Pete on every day is like, what's going on with your... with your limp? I'm like, oh, I've got Lego foot. It's kind of like plantar fasciitis.
Yeah.
Same concept. Lego foot. Lego toe. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, a new book is out by Chicago Review Press. It's called Junk, Digging Through America's Love Affair with Stuff. It's a great book that covers everything from junk removal professionals to the junk craze on television with shows like Pawn Stars and Antique Roadshow. But it really explores the main question. Why do we keep everything? What's our fascination with holding on to every little piece of junk that we probably will never use again? The author is Allison Stewart. Stewart, of course, is a longtime television and radio anchor. She's worked for NBC, ABC, CBS, NPR, and MTV News. She's currently a contributing correspondent for PBS. Allison will be at the bookseller in Lincoln Square this Saturday to speak and sign books, and she's here with us tonight on The Download. Allison, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So this is, I mean, this book is relatable across the board. I feel like this is something that's in my life as well. But, I mean, you got interested in this because of firsthand experience of cleaning out your parents' basement. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my late parents were sophisticated, lovely, elegant people with a beautiful home in Princeton, New Jersey. But we all knew there was this thing in the house called the basement. And honestly, if I could have poured concrete in there and say, I don't know what happened, I would have done it. But when it came time to have to sell the family home, my sister and I had to tackle just 40, 50 years of life that had accumulated in this basement. And, you know, when we go down there and I look around, I'm like, well, this isn't really a hoarding situation. This is a junk situation.
Yeah.
And it really took over my life. It took me about 8 months to clean out that basement. And the thing that was interesting was I would go to my kids' basketball games and people say, what are you doing? And I'd say, oh, God, I'm cleaning out my parents' basement. And everybody had a story. Everybody from the doorman's kid to the woman who put Bernie Madoff behind bars. Like, everybody had a story, a junk story about a relative, themselves, their parents. And my reporter radar went up. I said, what is going on here? And when your radar goes up, you start seeing it everywhere. And I was like, why are there so many TV shows about junk? How can junk removal be a respectable corporate enterprise? And it really just sent me on this down this rabbit hole of trying to think about who, what, where, when, and why of junk in the 21st century.
And this is not a book about, I mean, it has it, but it's not a book about hoarding. It's not
No.
a book about almost, you know, people going, you know, over the top. I mean, this is a book about everyday lives because, you know, you mentioned a lot of the stuff that was in your parents' basement was your stuff or your sister's stuff or in my case, the same thing. You know, all the things that I've said, hey, you know, hey, Dad, can you hold this for me? Can you put this in the basement? So it's a very shared experience. But there's a lot of emotion involved with this. There's a lot of connection to the junk that we store.
It's interesting, yeah. And in interviewing professional organizers who are sort of like the Justice League of dealing with junk, you know, there's a lot of science behind it. There's a lot of cognitive issues behind why we keep stuff. But as one woman just said it plain out, it's the attachment to the memory.
Yeah.
And it's actually, the science shows, it's very interesting that sometimes it's not the loss of the thing. It's not the thing itself. It's the loss of the thing and the pain that might bring forward that makes people hold on to stuff. It's not necessarily that I need that picture that my kid drew. It's like the idea of not having it is more painful.
That's so true. I mean that really resonates probably with everybody who's listening right now. The connection that we have to our stuff is not necessarily about it being useful, but it's about what it represents.
And it's also, I think, a real interesting mashup, a generational mashup going on, because you have people like my parents who were born in 1929, and my mother could not part with a Christmas bow because as a kid, right, she was poor. And that was a big deal to get a Christmas bow. So there were bags and bags of Christmas bows. Now, my sister's 10 years older, so she's a baby boomer. Now, they were taught to, you know, buy, buy, buy. That's the way we keep the economy going. And also, it was, you know, more cost efficient to buy new than to fix. We kind of lost the generations of being able to fix stuff. And then you have their kids who are millennials,
right,
who say, like, well, why do I want your photo albums? All my photos are on my phone.
It changes. I mean, junk is changing by the generation. I mean, millennials don't, they store things in a different way. They store things digitally.
And they also deal with a shared economy. They're much more likely to share a car. They're more likely to share a workspace. So there's sort of this weird thing where we're sort of at this point when there's just all this stuff around and nobody really wants it and nobody really knows how to, what to do with it and how to deal with it. And that's why I wanted to really focus part of the book on the junk professionals, this whole industry that's popped up around what to do and how to manage all of our stuff.
One of those professionals lives here in Chicago, Hector Caballero Jr. He's a junk vet. He's a vet who got into junk removal, but you follow him around, you talk to him about his job, which is pretty much you can pay Hector to come into your place and take away junk. And you talk, or you almost, you paint this picture of all the different places he goes to in the Chicago area, whether it be, you know, people who just need to get rid of junk or people who in a rush need, you know, a place cleaned out. There's a lot of emotion attached into the work that Hector does.
Yeah, Hector's a really interesting guy, and he's very much sort of an American success story. He's a Marine, former Marine. He's got Semper Fi tattooed on his arms. And when he got out of the Marine Corps, he was sort of trying to figure out what he was going to do with his life. And he's an enterprising guy, and he saw junk removal on TV, 1-800-GOT-JUNK. He thought, I can do that. He has that kind of, you know, I can do that spirit, that sort of go-getter Americana thing. You know, we were talking a lot about how service people are really strong professionals, and it's something that people don't necessarily think about. So he just decided he was going to do this. And he started a company called Junk Vets, and it was just happened to be, I didn't plan this, we ended up working on Memorial Day. And I followed him around for 3 days. I rode all over Chicago in some really good neighborhoods, some really bad neighborhoods. And, you know, it was kind of interesting. We tended to be, with him, it tended to be older people's houses. Now, I don't know if that's because older people had the association with the veteran, that it was going to be safe to have this person come to my house. But it was, it was people who were, he said it very poignantly, like, we're the last person in this process.
There's
there's
a great quote he has in the book where he says, you got to communicate with them and really connect with them when you take their stuff out. A lot of people have lost their parents, and you're watching them crying as you're taking their stuff out. We're the final guys in the final process of life. This is it.
It's true. And he has a great deal of respect for the people. And there's a great story in there about, you know, normally somebody's, you know, and this is not to disparage anybody else, but I think people would be super efficient. They're in and out. They don't talk to the people, you know, and that's good in some cases. But there was an older couple in the corner, and he saw the woman and got to talking and realized it's like the First Lady of Jazz of Chicago, Geraldine DeHaas.
Yeah.
That he was cleaning out her home and her husband's home, and they got into this great conversation. Hector, and it's also a really interesting story of immigrants. His folks were from, his grandparents were Tejanos who came up to work in Chicago, and they're very family-oriented, and he's very family-oriented. And I think that really works for him and his ability to connect with people. You know, other people, I went to 5 cities around the country, and I embedded myself with these junk removal teams. And then here's something so interesting. The junk that comes out of the houses really reflects sort of the socioeconomic situation of the cities.
Oh, of the cities, yeah.
Of the cities. Because in Austin, the first place I went, part of the junk removal was a piano. A beautiful piano, because this lovely couple were moving from their 5,000 square foot house to their 6,000 square foot house.
I don't think of that as junk. But, you know, it's what I really liked about a lot of the sort of back and forth in this book, but in the interviews, is the sort of dichotomy of, like in Hector's situation, not only was he removing junk from people's places, but he was collecting some of it. You know, like they're like, you can do whatever you want with it. But then he would grab it. He was amassing junk in his own place. There's just this, wherever we go, there seems to be this relationship with junk.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some people have asked me as I've started talking to people about the book, like, well, how do I not get junk? And I think that's a very smart question, because prevention is pretty much the only way at this point. Because I think the culture, it's very hard not to accumulate right now, right? Yeah. It's so available. It's so at our fingertips. Things that you can get into your house cheap. People know that if you touch something for, send something, you gain some ownership of it. The science shows that. But it's, you know, I couldn't figure out, like, what was my final takeaway? Like, how could I help people, you know, who go through this or reading this book? And I also want to say it's not an anti-junk book. There's plenty of people who love junk. It's just, it has to be useful for you.
Right.
And we need to take the time to think about, is this thing actually useful to me?
And
you know, why do I actually have it?
Right. Mindfulness.
Mindfulness, right?
Right.
I know it's an eye roll. I know it sounds like a yoga class and everything, but there's, but you know, I'm not sure human beings were meant to have access to so much all the time.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Like, I'm not sure if we can, if so much, well, it's 96 rolls of toilet paper in Costco, or it's 5 hamburgers for a dollar.
Right.
Like, I'm not sure we're wired to be able to say no to that.
There's the easy stuff that's like, well, you know, that's damaged or it's waterlogged but it really is kind of like an archaeological dig where, you know, you're peeling back. You know, Hector talked about that too, about the idea of peeling back. You get past layer to layer to layer and you kind of see how deep the junk goes.
And it also, this is something that was interesting, that all the science points to it, and it happened anecdotally in every junk removal I went to. For people who really start to be really challenged and have real difficulty with the amount of stuff around them, there's some traumatic event or just some emotional event. Because it can be the birth of a baby. It could be the death of a spouse. It could be changing of a home. It could be a relocation. And it's always the last thing you get to in the clean out.
Wow.
You can almost tell it to the date. Oh, this is when it started. This is when the person started having difficulty letting go of things for whatever reason.
The book is called Junk, Digging Through America's Love Affair with Stuff. You can see Allison signing books and speaking at the Bookseller in Lincoln Square this Saturday night, April 2nd. Allison Stewart, of course, longtime television and radio anchor for NBC, ABC, NPR, MTV News, all the big networks. Allison, thanks so much for taking some time out tonight.
Oh, well, I really appreciate your interest. Thanks so much.
I feel like that was a little bit of a bucket list scratch-off, having Allison Stewart on the show. I always loved her.
Yeah.
I mean, she's great on MTV. I feel like that was like a part of our youth.
Oh, yeah.
She was sort of like the Rock the Vote.
Yep.
I should have kept her around, and we should have done another 20 minutes just on Rock the Vote. Tell me what it was like to work for Kurt Loder. No, she's the book Junk, Digging Through America's Love Affair with Stuff. I was like, oh man, this is very relatable. And it's relatable because everybody has a basement or a storage facility, and mm-hmm. you got stuff in it, and you got to clean it out. I mean, she talks about, I mean, even the interview talked about 8 months. It took 8 months to finish off the basement of her parents' house.
I'm a bit of a hoarder. I'm better now, but I used to be in my old job, I had 5,000 VHS tapes of TV shows that I taped off the TV that I kept, episodes of Whoopi when she had a sitcom. I'm like, you know, I might need that for like a drop in or something. And then finally, like one day, it was like cut the cord, just threw them all out.
Darn it! Now think about how valuable those drop-ins would be.
I know,
drop-in from Whoopi right now.
I know. I know it's actually the because before My So-Called Life came out on DVD, I was a prized VHS possession because you couldn't get it anywhere. And the best part about it is seeing the old commercials. and the old graphics. It's always fun. So I don't have that anymore. But now it's like I'm obsessed. I get a lot of magazines, Sports Illustrated, Entertainment Weekly, and then I'll read them and I'll put them on in the pile. And then every once, like 6 months or so, I try to like thin them out. And I go through them like they mean something. Like, oh, let's see. Oh, I got to keep this one with Silicon Valley on the cover. I might go back and look at that.
You mentioned, I mean, Allison talked about the idea of the millennials or this generation, even people now. Junk is different. I think about, you know, the Schadenfreude comedy group that I've been a part of for 15, 16 years now. We have pared it down to 4 plastic bins. So we used to have an office up in Ravenswood and a whole bunch of memorabilia and props. And every time somebody wrote something, there were Xerox copies, there were books and VHS, just a million things. And over time, we had to clean that office out. I mean, it took like a day and a half to do. And then everything has been pared down. And Kate just moved to L.A., so I had to go up there with the old CRV and put the remaining stuff in. And I opened it up, and it's all irrelevant. Meaning, it's really interesting to go through, just like Allison talked about. There's a lot of memories and emotions, and, you know, a script may evoke a memory or a prop. But yeah, I mean, with the internet and digital and being able, I could just take out my phone and go, and then toss.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if I need the 32 Goodwill sports coats. You know, that was always what, you know, like, well, what if a character needs to look professional?
Yeah.
We have to have like 4, you know.
Yeah.
We have to have 4 tweed jackets, you know. Oh, I can't throw away these ties. There's a lot of that stuff. I'm like, what am I doing? This has no value whatsoever. Yeah. I my friend Maggie had a great idea for a segment. This could be a lot of fun, and we should do this on the down low. Because I feel like out of that, a lot of times emotion will get in the way, but there's always going to be, and Allison talked about it in the book, these great finds. You know, that's what Hector does. He finds these different things. Like, I got to keep this. I'm going to keep it. He almost became a hoarder by becoming a junk remover.
Yeah.
And she had this idea of like Chicago iconic memorabilia. And I just couldn't figure it out. I was trying to figure out how to do it. Maybe you can help us, Download Nation, with sort of organizing this idea. But the idea of almost like an antique roadshow for Chicago memorabilia. So somebody comes in and says, I have a Mayor Daley poster from 1983. It says, you know, he's on our side.
Yeah.
It's and I'm willing to trade it. And then other people call in and say, well, I have, you know, a T-shirt that says, you know, see Dick run, see Jane go, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, I'll trade. Like, that was the concept. But it had to be like, you know, because she was telling me she had this, she has an amazing collection of memorabilia, including like some police stars from like the 70s. Her dad was a police officer. So just some really cool stuff that's in her basement that she doesn't know what to do with, and she could keep it for sentimental value. But at the same time, you know, she might be something of value to somebody else.
Yeah.
So I thought that could be a cool exchange. Like, mm-hmm. I don't have a name for it or anything, but that could be a fun game.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think?
I like it.
Right?
Yeah.
Because there could be a lot of really crazy, wacky stuff that gets kind of traded. The only thing is then, you know, we have to figure out how to trade the stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's logistics. We could work that out. Yeah. But I like the concept is interesting.
We need a logistics guy. We should let's talk to Todd about hiring a consultant. We need to get a logistics consultant in here. That sounds like a character for the Character Flaws, right? Hi, I'm Justin Kaufman, logistics consultant. You put a stamp on it, send it him. He puts a stamp on, puts it back. $150 an hour. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. Coming up, Michelle Wooker will be here to talk about the Gray Rhino. She's my guest at the big table. But first, let's get to the news. What do you think? What do you think of my my idea of the sort of antique roadshow for Chicago artifacts, Rob?
I think it's a good idea.
See,
join us for the swap meet on the download.
Boom!
Boom!
That's name generator.
Right. So now what you are, man. You did highbrow as well. Here's what we need, though. Now we have to get the logistics consultant, and we have to get the sales team involved.
I think we need a focus group as well.
We're gonna need a focus group as well. Shoot. That's like 5. It's at least 10 people. Someone to coordinate that focus group. Oh, man.
Yeah, but focus groups are easy. Donuts in the morning, pizza in the afternoon.
Pizza. So we're going to need a food coordinator. I'm just getting this all down. So we're going to have to ask Todd for it's $175,000. That's not a big deal. That's not a big deal for swap meet. No, I think that's right in line with the market trends.
Yeah.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Andy Kindler's going to be here, stand-up comedian, who's all over the place. He's been on IFC's Marin just recently. He plays Mark Marin's friend on the show, and he also does this great thing at Just for Laughs in Montreal where he gives a state of the industry every year. So we're going to sort of get a progress report from Andy Kindler coming up here on the download. Also, coming up a little bit later, the American Theater Company here in Chicago is changing leadership. Will Davis comes in from New York. He's going to be taking over as the artistic director. Even though this was part of the original series that's already been put together or season, his play Kill Floor, Abe Kugler's play Kill Floor, who Will Davis is good buddies with, is on stage at American Theater Company. We'll talk about what it takes to put on a play, namely rehearsal. I'm always fascinated with the rehearsal process, how people use it, how different people put it together. So we will talk with Abe Kugler and Will Davis coming up a little bit later in the show. My guest tonight at the big table, Chicago author, taking one of the biggest psychological issues of our time, Michelle Wooker, is the author of the book, The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore. Now, I consider this issue to be at the top of our mounting problems because inaction or willful ignorance has caused and will cause serious harm. Financial meltdowns, climate change, and closer to home, pension debt, it's a big thing. You can even kind of put this into play when it comes to violence, to gun violence, and how we're reacting to some of the things that are happening in Chicago's neighborhoods. So why do we, as human beings, continue to kick the can and collectively act like deer in headlights when it comes to the current dangers lurking in our immediate futures? Michelle Wooker has been the president of the World Policy Institute and vice president of studies at Chicago Council of Global Affairs. And she's authored other books like Lockout, Why America Keeps Getting Immigration Wrong When Our Prosperity Depends on Getting It Right. Michelle Wooker, welcome to the download. Thanks for being here.
I'm very happy to be here.
All right, so let's get into this book. I love the book. I think it's great. And, you know, The Gray Rhino, when I first picked it up, I was like, oh, yeah, The Gray Rhino. Like, I know that they're endangered. I know that this has something to do. And as I started reading, I realized it had more to do not just with that issue, but the issue of how we sort of perceive a gray rhino in the wild. But talk about why you named this gray rhino.
Sure. Well, I was trying to come up with an image for the big thing that's in front of you. It's coming right at you. I wanted to get at the difference between people who see something like that and do something about it and the ones who don't. So I'd been trying and trying to get this image, and all of a sudden I was explaining it to a friend, and this rhino image. I said, like a rhinoceros. And so he made a joke referring to The Black Swan, a book that came out almost 10 years ago about highly improbable, high-impact threats, basically saying you don't pay enough attention to highly improbable things. So he made a Black Swan joke saying, oh, it's like a black rhino. And I went, wait a minute, there's such a thing as a black rhino, but isn't there a white rhino? You know, let me go to Wikipedia. I learned a lot about rhinos in the course of writing a book. But I looked it up, and then I realized this is exactly what I'm talking about, because black rhinos aren't black. White rhinos aren't white. They're all gray.
They're all gray.
It's that obvious, but we go off asking what color they are, and we miss what's right in front of us.
We miss it. It's charging right at us. And we're like, what kind of rhino is it? I mean, but really, this has to do with human behavior. This book is about how we deal with impending doom. And it's funny because today even I saw a story that the scientists say that the sea levels are going to rise 50 feet in 500 years. A lot of people say, well, I'm not going to be around in 500 years, or that doesn't really affect me, or someone else will figure it out. And what your book really gets into is why we do that as human beings, why there's impending doom in our face, and why we choose to ignore it.
It's a very natural impulse in some ways. This denial helps to protect us from a shock. If something's so big that you can't handle it, if you really think about it completely, you'll shut down. And so there's a little bit of a protection mechanism, but it's meant to be temporary. It's meant to get in place what you need to do so that you can mm-hmm. act, so that the initial shock is not too much. And then on top of that, there are all sorts of other reasons, the you know, perverse incentives, there are political reasons, there's, you know, short-term thinking, they're the way our minds work, that we'll put more attention on what's more recent or what's right in front of us, and it warps things. So there are all sorts of reasons. Some of them are in our head and some of them are things that we make up as individuals or as society. And some of them are, of course, entrenched, deeply, deeply powerful structures. And a lot of people have said to me as I've been talking about the book, well, that's just the way it is. We can't do anything about it. And I think people like to listen to themselves sound like this hardened cynic. They know how the world works. But the truth is, it actually doesn't have to be that way.
Right. And you're in the book, I mean, there's so many different, and we'll get into it in this hour, but one of the things you talk about when it comes to human behavior is groupthink. And the idea that we kind of we all say that at the same time. We all kind of say, well, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. Nothing we can do. We all do it together. You know, that you start to see that we almost do it together for that protection.
We do very much. You look at the financial crisis, you know, afterwards, all the people saying, oh, nobody saw it coming. Nobody saw it coming. And I look back at, you know, I had an apartment in New York City. The price almost doubled in 4 years. I sold my apartment because I thought what goes up must come down.
Right.
And I'd been a financial journalist. I'd spent a lot of time looking at liquidity bubbles.
And even before the bubble broke, I mean, every weekend there was a huge piece on how the bubble was going to burst.
Absolutely.
So there was warning.
And you do a search, a Nexus search of newspaper articles at the time, and there were a lot of mentions of it. In the summer of 2008, Christine Lagarde, who at the time was the finance minister in France, came out and said, we are facing a financial tsunami. I mean, there were a lot of people who said it was coming. The Bank for International Settlements had a big report. And there were lots of reasons why people wanted to believe it wasn't going to happen. But there very much is this reinforcement. You've got this party going on and nobody wants to
right.
take the punch bowl away.
And that was a lot of what The Big Short was about, which you talk about in the book. But what I find interesting about that is that, you know, a lot of the people that, you know, the first thing I would say is there's a lot of people who are making money off of that. So some issues, I mean, sometimes it's just the simplest answers that people were just being greedy and they wanted to make money off it. And but the bigger question is, why didn't the people whose job it was to protect the economy, or just the people like you and me living out here, stand up and say, we have to fix this before it breaks?
I think part of it was structural obstacles. I think it's terrible incentives. It's behind who paid to get certain people in office, to get anyone in office. But there also is this very intense psychological need to keep going up. In some ways, greed is stronger than fear. And on the other hand, there was really this sense that, well, you know, the government will bail us out. We're too big to fail.
Right.
You know, something will happen.
Someone will bail us out.
Someone will bail us out. It's this sense of magical thinking which goes through everything in culture. You even look at movies. You know, at the end, you're trying to figure out how the hero is going to get out of whatever the mess. And it's usually something that you're not supposed to be able to predict if the script writer has done
right.
their job right.
right.
You know, it's often this thing that just kind of, you know, plops in out of the blue, this magical thing. My favorite example is in you know, Mars Attacks, where they've got these aliens coming in and they're attacking Earth and they're taking things over, and they go out to some little farmhouse way in the middle of nowhere, and there's this little old granny, and she turns on this Slim Pickens song, and all of a sudden their brains start exploding inside of the little glass bowls on top of their heads. And to me, that's a perfect example of what we wish would happen. Something magical is going to get us out of the way of trouble.
The book is called The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore. The author is Michelle Wooker. She's my guest tonight here at the big table. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We have to talk climate change, because that really is, I mean, that's the gray rhino in the room. So we'll talk about that when we come back. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, author Michelle Wooker. Her book, The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore. I when I saw this come through and I saw the you know, the subject, and it's fascinating to me. I mean, it says so much, because we live in a state where, I mean, we are in the middle of it. We have a budget crisis. We have a pension debt, both here in the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois, where it not only was a big part of kicking the can down the road, but there's so much denial. There's so much someone's going to bail us out. I mean, it is the gray rhino here in the state of Illinois. But you mentioned there's five stages of sort of the gray rhino concept. There's denial, there's muddling, which I want to ask about, bargaining or diagnosis, panic, and then the action or the trampling, which in this, you know, whichever how you want to look at it.
You hope that the action comes first and there's trampling, but that's for lucky people.
Those are let's go through that. Denial is usually the first step.
Sure. And of course, with thinking about denial, I go back to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross on Death and Dying and the Five Stages of Grief.
Right.
And it was maybe a little too easy, but I couldn't resist. Once you got denial, you got to have five stages, right? But it actually also worked when I started thinking through how these things come together. And so denial is the beginning. It's where our brains get in our way, the groups that we're in get in the way, and we just don't want to recognize what's there.
Right. We see that in the pension stuff. We see that in climate change. I mean, that's the beginning stage.
It is. And it's interesting with climate change is that sometimes it's in our heads and sometimes it's manufactured. You know, other people take advantage of the fact that we don't want to see what's in front of us. And they will do whatever they can to.
So they use denial as a manipulation tool.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Very much so.
Okay, so denial is the first thing. The second thing is muddling. What is muddling?
So muddling is you know that there is a problem there. You're not saying it doesn't exist anymore, but you're trying to come up with reasons not to do anything about it.
Right.
A couple of the examples in the book are the European debt crisis and the Greek crisis and the fact that the European currency is set up in such a way that it's almost impossible to work unless they bring countries closer together with their financial and economic policies, and that's really, really tough.
Yeah.
Another example is infrastructure. You know, there's a chapter in the book about the bridge in Minnesota,
right.
that collapsed. I actually went and saw the memorial for it. And, you know, there had been warnings for years and years about that. But still, it wasn't even scheduled to be replaced for a long time. And you look, there are about 80,000 bridges in the states that have problems. And about 8,000 of those are both structurally deficient and fracture critical, which means that one thing goes, the whole thing goes under.
Right.
That's an awful lot of bridges. And there it's a question of resources, you know, short-term resources versus a crisis. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, money seems to magically appear from some big federal pot of money when you have a crisis.
Right.
And it costs many times more to fix something.
And that's what we see in any sort of budget situation when it comes to priority is the crisis. Mm-hmm. But infrastructure is a great example of where if we did a little bit of the pain up front or we, you know, covered it, we wouldn't have the issues that we had when the Minnesota bridge collapsed back in 2000.
And it's a vicious circle, too,
yeah.
Because if you think you can't afford it now, well, once there's a big crisis and the cost is even more, you're going to have a harder time dealing with things in the future. So it becomes a real cost-benefit problem.
All right, so let's go to stage three, which I have as bargaining. You also say diagnosis. Talk about that.
Sure. Well, that's where you really got to figure out what it is that you're going to do. It's coming up with the right thing to fix the problem. And that means, in some cases, figuring out what kind of problem you have. Is it something that's completely impossible? Is it a Gordian knot? Is it like Syria? How connected is it to other problems? If you have two problems, does one of them cause the other problem?
Right.
You know, in which case you start at the beginning of the chain and you fix the problem that's going to set all the other dominoes falling. And it's also a question of how easy is the solution? How many people are on board with fixing it? And all of those things help you to figure out what you're going to do. What I found to be very interesting was that there's really not much reward for picking the right solution, because how many crises that didn't happen do we know about?
Right.
You don't celebrate people for preventing a crisis.
Right. If a state allowed funds for infrastructure and we fixed up some infrastructure and there was never a bridge collapse, they don't get heralded during election season for that.
No, they get called a tax and spend.
Right.
But, you know, in even more extreme examples, and my favorite one is Joan of Arc. You know, she went and she saved the French. And She got burned at the stake for it.
She got captured, and then there was reluctance to, because there was, what was it, witchcraft and other things were thrown out. So there was reluctance to even go help her. I mean, it really, yeah, it follows the gray rhino kind of philosophy.
Yeah, and the odds are stacked against doing the right thing. The other example I look at is Herbert Hoover in the Great Depression. Now, he actually did something. Now, what he did made the situation worse, which was not his intent, but he did something. And people don't realize just how hard it is, in some cases, to do something. And what we've seen recently is the cases where people do something just for the sake of something,
right,
is often they'll do something symbolic, like everybody take off your shoes at the airport, which,
right,
costs us, you know, billions and tens of billions of dollars a year, instead of that money that could go into better intelligence. There,
right,
are all sorts of other much more cost-effective things.
And you are
things.
In the book, too. There are some times when, you know, I mean, the idea of making the right decision at the right time, because you mentioned with the Herbert Hoover, kind of made the decision a little too early. And other examples throughout your book about, you know, it's one thing to take action, to go against the sort of gray rhino principle of inaction, take action, but then there's another to do it at the right time. Which complicates things.
It's hard, and that's actually where panic comes in.
It's the fourth stage, yeah.
It's the fourth stage, and it's where you really don't want to be. But it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, in a state of panic, we'll often make very bad decisions. Like, for example, when you're in the middle of a big boom, nobody wants to talk about cutting budgets. And it's only when you're in this spiral down when you talk about it, and that's exactly the time when you shouldn't be. That's when you should have your rainy,
right,
day fund. It's exactly what
it's
that's
happening
for.
Here, yeah.
But on the other side, panic sometimes is what you need to get people who are reluctant to act to come along with it. And you get this interesting relationship between the muddling stage and the panic stage. In muddling, sometimes you know what the right thing is. You might even have a good plan for it, but for whatever political reasons, you can't make it happen. But if you can keep that plan there, if you can do little things that get you towards where you need to go, once that panic stage hits, if you've got the best blueprint,
you can use it. You can,
yeah,
make
so
it happen.
It's not all bad, but you really don't want to be there.
And that's and really the fifth is to take action, or in the case, if you're not prepared to be trampled. That's
boom.
That's the fifth stage of the gray rhino principle. The book is called The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore. The author is Michelle Wooker. She's with me for the hour. Let's take a break so we can get to the news with Rob. We come back, more of this conversation, including climate change, which we haven't talked about. And also, I want to talk about predictions and risk, because it's a big part of what Wall Street's about and how we as human beings respond and react to predictions, risk, and that kind of thing. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Valparaiso loses in the NIT championship game. You know, I guess I'll go back to being just a casual observer of the team now. In the last 2 weeks, I've become like a Valpo fan, like a college basketball Valpo fan. And they went all the way there, and they didn't win the championship. So now, yeah, you know what? Wait till next year. My guest tonight at the big table here is Michelle Wooker. She's the author of The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore. This is just a fascinating concept to me. I'm just amazed by the book. It's a great read. It comes out next week. Is that right?
Tuesday.
Congratulations. Do you have like a big book party and all that kind of stuff? Like plan? What are you going to do?
I've actually got a couple of gatherings with small groups of friends, and well, one not so small group in New York. And then I'm doing a reading on the Upper West Side at the Barnes & Noble.
That's
there.
That's great.
In New York. Yeah, yeah. And there's part of the preface is about an incident that happened in the neighborhood. They had all these pedestrian deaths, and there,
right,
had been report after report after report about why the streets were configured wrong. There was an exit from the highway right there, right in front of a school. And I knew a friend, an editor from Newsweek, who'd been killed there, and just all of these terrible deaths. And as I was writing the book, three people were killed within about 10 days of each other. Mm. And it became a major, major, major thing in the city. So I'll be talking about that there.
Well, I mean, it's like we kind of said, I mean, the gray rhino, that's it almost replaces the elephant in the room. I mean, how many people who are listening right now can be like, that's a gray rhino. That's it. We talk about pension crisis here in the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago. That's a gray rhino. Climate change, obviously, that's a gray rhino. You know, everything we've been talking about tonight, plus 20, 30 more things that you can think about. I mean, macro, micro, the whole lot. And one of the big ones that you talk about in the book is the financial meltdown. I mean, we talked about the market collapse or just the housing bubble bursting in 2007, 2008. And one of the things that was interesting is Wall Street. Wall Street's role, or not role in that collapse, but Wall Street's role in this book. You talked to some people involved with it. You caught up with somebody who really made his name on predictions and talk about that, because that's a big part of this is how we as human beings sort of react and deal with predictions.
We've got a very, very complicated relationship with predictions. I mean, everybody, of course, loves to say in hindsight, oh, I predicted that,
right?
Even when they didn't. And then you never really see people get called on the fact that they said, oh, well, I predicted that. And you say, okay, well, what did you do about it? And, of course, then they change the subject.
Right.
But it's interesting. I think we're much more eager to go along with what other people say. And if a prediction doesn't turn out the way we want, we just cast it away and forget that it ever happened. It just goes poof in a cloud of smoke. And the chapter you're talking about in the book, the interview I did was with Byron Reen, who's the vice chair at Blackstone.
Right, right, right.
And I just love his list every year. They're called the 10 surprises, where he comes up with a list of things that he thinks are going to happen that affect the markets that he thinks have a greater than 50% chance of happening, but that the market as a whole thinks is less than a third. And obviously there's as much art as science in that. But what I love about it is he's not afraid to be wrong.
Yeah, right. The relationship with being wrong. That's what I loved about it. The concept that he wasn't sort of like pouring over it and being like, if I'm wrong, he's okay with being wrong. I mean, that was he embraced being wrong.
But it wasn't natural. And he actually is from Chicago originally as well, which I learned as I was interviewing him. But when he was thinking about doing the list at the beginning, you know, his friend said, don't do this.
No,
because when you're wrong, they're going to skewer you. And he's, you know, there are some sites out there that have had quite a bit of fun with him. And he's, you know, he's totally okay with it. But the first set of predictions that came out, and yes, there were some things that were wrong, he realized afterwards, he's like, well, so what? It wasn't that bad. So we need to be a lot less afraid of being wrong.
Right. And there's a relationship we have with predictions because the layman kind of approach to predictions is, oh, the world's going to end in 2010 and then it doesn't happen. Right. Or we see, you know, I predict here, scientists are going to predict we're not going to have any ice left in the continent by this year, by what have you. And people really, really dig in to be contrary, to challenge, almost to develop groupthink around, sort of taking on that prediction. Wow. What is that?
It's very interesting. And people don't call themselves when they get things wrong, which is another thing I liked about Byron Reen is he at the end of the year says, this is what I got right. This is what I got wrong. And I learned that you can calibrate yourself. I participate in a project called the Good Judgment Project, which is online. It's fascinating. It's sort of like a crowdsourced set of predictions. But when you sign up, you have to do a little test. They give you a Breyer score is what it's called. It's basically a test on whether you are overconfident, underconfident, or just right, which mm-hmm. is the plan. So when you make your predictions, you actually get judged on how confident you are on the predictions. And I found that over the course of a number of months, as I was doing these predictions, I got better at it. And I got much better at calibrating how certain I was and why I was certain and why I wasn't.
Right.
And figuring out when I needed more.
What do you think that was? Was that confidence? What was it about? What made that change?
I think it's a skill. I think it's being mindful of something, which is part of the reason I think that the idea of having a gray rhino is so incredibly important is that you think of something that's coming at you that you've got a choice to deal with or not. And it's a real evolution from the elephant in the room. And the elephant room just stands there. Mm-hmm. And the very definition of it is something that's big and huge, but that nobody's
paying
looks
attention
at.
To. Right.
And
right,
it tends to just kind of stand mm-hmm. still. So it's a little boring. And it gives people an easy out. And so just by being mindful of the fact that there are gray rhinos out there helps you to reorient the way you face the world. Just like being mindful of why you're predicting what you are, why you're making the decisions you are. Those sort of little things can have a very big impact on your life, on your business, and on your role in the world.
Climate change, you know, been kind of that's the ultimate when it comes to gray rhinos, because we've seen it, we've talked about it. I mean, Al Gore had the Inconvenient Truth, you know, and it just seems over and over that so many people are throwing out warning signs. This is happening. This wouldn't have happened 20, 50, 100 years ago. Our planet is changing. We are making a change. I mean, you're seeing politics, everything involved in it. Is this almost the ultimate when it comes to the gray rhino concept?
Climate change very much could be the ultimate gray rhino. When I was starting out doing the research and the brainstorming for the book, I had a lot of, meals and drinks with friends where I just asked them to pull off the top of their head. And climate change far and above was the top gray rhino that
because it's
picked.
I mean, it's a perfect example of denial into the next step, you know, all the way through from bargaining to, I mean, panic is on its way. I mean, it follows the blueprint that you set out in this book.
What's interesting about it, too, is that there are different groups of people in the world and not all of them are in the same stage. And so you can, you know, the ideal is that you've got some people who are ready for action and they've got to figure out how to motivate everyone else, how to bring them along.
Right.
The group of people who are in total denial are smaller and smaller. And frankly, some of the people in that denial group, I think publicly are in denial, but privately they know what's going on and they just don't care. They're going to make a bet.
They're in that same, what we talked about right at the beginning with groupthink and the concept where we're like, well, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I really can do. I'm going to continue my life.
But if, say, for example, you've got a lot of money at stake in the fossil fuel industry. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know that climate change is a problem. Yes, you're going to lose a lot of money eventually, but if you can push it out far enough into the future, if you've got enough money that you can beat back the new technologies that compete with it, you could trick yourself into thinking that it's not a big deal. But what really struck me was I was on a trip in the Middle East last October. And we talked to some of the sovereign wealth funds and we asked some of them, you know, what's the thing that you're most worried about? What keeps you up at night? And it was the obsolescence of oil. And you look at some of the news articles that have been coming out in the Middle East. There was one, you know, Morocco, the new solar center of the Emirates. They're experimenting with renewable energy, all of these very, very interesting technologies.
So interesting, because you're right. I mean, we have so many different people and groups of people that are on different pages or different stages of the gray rhino kind of, concept that you put together. You really have to figure out a way to get everybody to understand everybody else's point of view. A lot to talk about. We'll continue the conversation. Michelle Wooker is the author of The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore. We'll wrap up after the break. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. My guest at the big table, author Michelle Wooker. We're talking about the book, The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore. And we ignore a ton. That's what we're finding out about this hour. I don't want it to all be doom and gloom, because there at the end, you know, you do have a sort of rhino safari guide, and I want to get into that. Before we do that, back to the species itself, the gray rhino. It's one of the ironies of this is that the gray rhino is facing, you know, it's an endangered species. There's been a lot of poaching, a lot of trouble for the species. Almost it's got its own gray rhino problem.
Yeah,
you know, that's really what it is.
You say that the humans are the gray rhino rhino.
Right. And you talk about it here. You say, you know, now you're at a crucial moment where the survival of the species depends on creating political will in a challenge that goes to the heart of the question behind this book. So political will is important, and it's sort of the one thing that kind of motivates us to do something.
Very much so. Very much so. And I think what helps to create it is the ability to look at something that's scary and say, hey, this is actually an opportunity to be able to find hope in things. And the image I ended the book on was actually at the Lincoln Park Zoo with a baby who's not so baby anymore, baby
right.
King,
right.
The rhino. And I have to say, you know, 2-year-old, I forget, 1,600-pound rhino nursing. That is a sight to see, let me tell you. Talk about adversity. Oh, you know, the mother was just, she just had this look on her face like, oh, I can't wait till he grows up.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you do at the end of the book is the Gray Rhino Safari Guide, which is a set of principles, or as you say, in other words, how to not get run over by a gray rhino. So the first one is to recognize the rhino.
Absolutely. That goes to the denial. Mm-hmm. Just say, okay, this is here. And one of the easiest things everybody can do, whether it's talking about their life, whether it's their job, whether it's about the things in the world or in the city that you care about, is just make a list. What are the top 3 gray rhinos? The top gray rhino in my life, the top gray rhino at work, in my industry, you know, in my city, on the planet. And you know, track those.
Yeah.
Make sure you've got a sense of it. And ask yourself, take a really hard look, what am I seeing that I'm not seeing? You know, what am I not paying attention to? A friend of mine, I talked about the book, and she said, oh, wow, the end of my marriage was a gray rhino. She said, all my friends were trying to tell me, and I just didn't want to see it. So you might ask the people around you if there's a gray rhino that you're not seeing.
That's great. And I mean, number 2 is define the rhino, which is what we kind of got talked about. Number 3, don't stand still.
And that's the tough one, because people do, you know?
They do.
People really don't want to move. We're set in our ways.
The rhino is charging at you, and you're like, I'm not going to move.
No.
This is going to work out. Someone's going to save me. I'm going to stand still.
Yeah, I actually had my niece do some research for me online when I was at the very beginning of the book. I was like, okay, what do you do? And there's all sorts of things. You know, the main thing is to get in the Jeep and you know, drive right. as fast as you can.
Don't be in that situation, right.
But, you know, people, I think people are very likely not to do anything. So that's a real hurdle, and we need to recognize it. But we don't need to take it for granted. We don't need to give in to it. I think that's the real central message of the book, is that you do have the power to make the decision to do something about it. And don't be afraid of doing the wrong thing. Sometimes you'll get to the right thing by doing the wrong thing.
You know, one of the other things here, too, is a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. You mentioned the Chicago fire. You know, it was a bad situation, but it also catalyzed a building boom. So, I mean, if you are charged by a rhino or the gray rhino charges and you're able to, you know, survive, mm-hmm. Use that.
Absolutely. And people are more likely to do something right after something really bad has happened. And hopefully that can kick them into the kind of long-term thinking that will prevent the next big bad thing from happening. You look at the end of the Great Depression and the Glass-Steagall Law came in, which meant that we went a very, very long time until the next big disruption like that. And I think part of the reason that people kicked Glass-Steagall to the side was they forgot how bad it was. So sometimes you need the memory of a crisis, or sometimes someone else's crisis can wake you up to what you need to do in your own backyard.
Mm-hmm. And one of the last ones here, be a rhino spotter, become a rhino keeper.
That one I just love. And I came up with that concept. And it was in my head, but I didn't have a word for it until I talked with my friend Mina Gulli, who has just finished running 7 marathons in 7 deserts on 7 continents.
Wow.
Actually 40 marathons. Apologies. It was 7 deserts, 7 continents, 7 weeks, 40 marathons to draw attention to water scarcity. and to the fact that everything we wear, everything we eat, everything we do uses way more water than brushing our teeth or the shower or whatever. And it was an absolutely nutty, crazy thing to do. And I talk about her in the book and about the fact that there are so few people and what treasures they are when you find them, when they see a big problem like that that other people might not be paying attention to and say, this is scary, this is the future of our planet, and I'm going to do something about it, and I don't care how crazy people think I am. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like Joan of Arc. You know, so what if they think I'm nuts, a little girl fighting off the whole English army? And being a rhino keeper is really, it comes to this idea that rhinos may seem scary, but they're actually our allies. And when you're able to see the rhino there, you've actually got a friend in helping you to recognize the problems that are there.
There's so much more in this book. Check it out. The Gray Rhino, How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore. We didn't talk about social media. We didn't talk about privacy. We didn't talk about the issues other gray rhinos that come to trying to figure out how we're going to live life with this new technology. There's so much in here that is relevant to the issues and the, I guess, the challenges we have as a society. Michelle Wooker is the author. She has been the president of the World Policy Institute, vice president of studies at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and she's also authored other books like Lockout, Why America Keeps Getting Immigration Wrong When Our Prosperity Depends on Getting It Right. Michelle, thanks so much for being my guest tonight.
Thank you. This has been so much fun talking with you.
The Cubs have a 4-1 lead over the Mets.
Let's get this on. I'm telling you, man, spring training is over. Start it. Way too many games.
I'll tell you what. I'm going to go into hibernation. You wake me up at game 152.
Now, Zim doesn't like that. He likes game 10. He's a game 22 kind of guy.
And game 13 into the season, Bob, and we've got some real problems here on the north side. We'll get to the starting lineups right after this.
I can't wait, man.
Oh, my God. I mean, what do you accomplish in 162 games that you can't get to in 142?
Well, Rob, they have to figure out a way to make $1 trillion. Once they have that figured out, then I'm surprised that they have not said, you know what this needs? 250 games.
Did we all take macroeconomics? I think we did. Look, you decrease the supply, you increase the demand, and you jack up the ticket price a little bit. Not that big a deal.
We could all tailgate outside Wrigley Field for the 8 home games.
And just think, a few less games at Wrigley Field means that we get to see Billy Joel at least 3 more times during the summer.
Good stuff. Because she likes to be like I like the brew. Pump the pony keg, refilling my 22 with the ales, Pilsner, lager, or the stout. Hops till the party stops, I make the people shout. Call the cops, call us. All right, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Andy Kindler. I was going to say great Chicago stand-up, but he's coming to. He's a New York stand-up, and he's coming to Space in Evanston next week. Talking to Andy about his career, but also about the state of the stand-up comedy industry. He's sort of the elder statesman, and he gets on stage every year at the Just for Laughs Festival for the keynote, the state of the industry speech. So we'll get a little progress report from Andy coming up. And then 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk with the new leadership at the American Theater Company, as well as some live music from Bill Bricky. Lots to come here on the download. We're only halfway through the show. Well, coming up in May, the 7th annual Beer Under Glass fundraiser is going to take place. It's a huge party and fundraiser for the Garfield Park Conservatory. It features some great Chicago craft beer and a party with music and mingling in the conservatory. What else would you want? It also is the kickoff event for the Chicago Craft Beer Week, truly one of Chicago's best parties. And since tickets just went on sale, we begged them to give us some so we could give them to you, Download Nation. Look at us. Joining me on the line is Pat Deedy. He's a partner in the law firm of Hogan, Marin, Babbo, and Rose here in Chicago. He's also the vice chair of the board of the Garfield Park Conservatory Alliance. Pat's been on with us a few times talking legal news. But once we figured out he was involved in this event, we called in a couple of favors. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Justin.
You know, like, we're not talking a legal case. We're talking beer tonight. Talk about this party, because this truly has. I mean, it's the 7th annual. This has become sort of one of Chicago's best.
It people who go, I think it is the best craft beer festival of the season. It really is the big, as you said, the kickoff for Craft Beer Week. We're going to have probably, we've increased the number of tickets this year, so we're up probably to the maximum that we can easily accommodate in the 12 or 13 acres of space out there at the conservatory. But, you know, both indoor showrooms, all eight of them will be open all evening. And there's about, you know, there's three separate gardens in the front and the side and the back. And people, there's going to be about 100, we're estimating 100 brewers are going to be pouring their spring drafts. And it's always a great time. I mean, it, the brewers love it. They get to mingle with people and talk about their craft. People get to, who've never been out to the conservatory get to come and see what a great place it is. It's really been a very great partnership with the Illinois Craft Beer Guild, Craft Brewers Association.
Let me ask you, I mean, why do you get involved with the Garfield Park Conservatory? You personally, why are you the vice chair?
Well, I grew up on the west side. I always used to go there when I was younger. And I was out there for the 100th anniversary in 2008. They had a big party. Florotica was a fashion show with models and small outfits made of flowers, and that would hook me. I thought it was a great organization. I love the conservatory, and it's, if you haven't been, you need to go, and if you haven't been in a long time, you need to come back.
Yeah, it's a great place.
It's a great place.
All right, so tonight, so like we said, I mean, we found out you were involved in this party. I mean, we were starting to, we brought the Rolodex out, and we're like, who can get us tickets? Didi can get us tickets. So what do we have? What are we going to give? We want to give it away to Download Nation. What do they get with these tickets?
Okay, there's two tickets, which are the VIP tickets. So you get in an hour early. So you get in at 5:30 to the conservatory. No big lines. You get a chance to try all the beers and food that you want before the crowd gets there. You have, you know, there will be. There's going to be this year for something new. The brewers want to set up a rare beer tent, which will be out on the lawn. So you can venture out there and try some of the truly unique beers that are going to be available, as well as the 100 other stands that will be up and around. You know, it's easy to get to. You're going to be either, you can hop in a cab from the Loop or jump on the Green Line. It's going to be a great time. We still have some regular tickets available. These are the VIPs, general admission are on sale. You can go to garfieldpark.org or go right to Brown Paper Tickets. Just hit beer under glass and, you can, you know, we still got some left. We didn't sell out the first day. Usually we sell out the first day, but, this year we put some more tickets in the popper, and
we've got
some more to sell.
I'm glad that you didn't give us some of that Gen Ed stuff, because you know that's just not how we roll here. I mean, we're more of a VIP show. All right, so let's do it.
I heard.
That's what you've heard. So why don't we do the 20th caller? Does that sound good,
Pete?
20th, 21st. What do you think?
20th and 21st. We have two.
We have two. I think we have two tickets.
We have two sets of two.
Oh, two sets of two. There we go. Okay, it's 20th and 21st calls. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And you can get VIP to the Beer Under Glass fundraiser, which will take place in May. Pat Didi, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We appreciate the gift, and we will be talking to you soon. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot, Justin. Bye.
Woo, the lines are lit up. We have our winners. Pete Zimmerman's taking them down now for the Beer Under Glass VIP tickets for the fundraiser for the Garfield Park Conservatory, which happens coming up here in May. It's the 7th annual Beer Under Glass fundraiser. You can get tickets. Just Google Garfield Park Conservatory, Beer Under Glass, and you can get some general admission tickets. Woo! It's nights like these when you give away tickets, Pete, that you recognize that people do listen.
Oh, man.
Like, there's probably
those
a good,
there's
like 150 people just called.
Whew. I want to go to this thing.
I know. Well,
I think we're going to be working.
I think what you're going to need to do is convince the people who won to bring you. That's not going to.
Yeah. That's when I told one of the winners, I've said, it's you have to take me.
And there was a
as their
pause.
Plus one. And then they're like, I'm breaking up.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, thanks. Never mind. We have a couple of pairs, and what we're going to do is we're going to continue to give them away as part of some of the other fine programming here. so we won't do it tonight, but we could give them away. Maybe we can give away a pair or two for the worst.
Yes.
That would be good because we always give away tickets on Mondays.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe on Monday we'll do it. This Monday coming up. Beth Malusi is going to join us to play the worst.
Terrific. She's hilarious.
She was also the host of Cash Cab Chicago. So we'll talk. We'll have her on the worst on Monday. So maybe we'll give away the best worst. We'll get tickets to Beer Under Glass. It's a great fundraiser. I mean, you're right. I guess we are. We probably are working if it's on a weeknight.
Yeah. I mean, in the way the Hawks are playing, I don't think they're going to be playing past the mid-April.
That's what we said last year, though. I remember we started. I mean, we're coming up on a year here. Yeah, it was like end of April we started, and we're like, remember they were like, the Nashville team's very fast. It's a very tough team. They won't let the Blackhawks come down, the fans come down to Nashville, and then we won that, and then it was off to the races.
I don't know. I've been paying attention a little bit more, been scrutinizing, Mayor Daly would say, been scrutinizing the team over the past couple of weeks. And like every time they play a team that's like a competitive team, a team that they're kind of in the hunt for, a team that's in the playoff hunt, they're like 0-8-3 in those games.
That's weird.
I mean, I shouldn't count them out. I mean, history shows that they've. I just think they've played a lot of hockey for the last year, and I think they're wearing down.
Yeah, it's possible.
It's tough to
repeat. But at the same time, absolutely, and to win as many as they have in the last couple of years. But I always think of those late. I mean, if we're truly believing that this Blackhawks team, which there's no reason not to, is a dynasty. You think of those Bulls teams of the 90s, and around this time, the end of the season, I mean, there's a 72-10 season, there's no doubt, where that was a magical season.
Yeah.
But the seasons after that, there was a lot of, well, I don't know if they can keep up with a team like Miami Heat, or, you know, I think the Lakers give them some trouble. The Jazz got something going on. And, you know, and you were right. You'd see it on paper, and you're like, man, that's a tough team. They're fast. You know, this Jordan and Pippen are getting old. But when you got to the playoffs, they knew how to play in the playoffs, and they got it done.
Let's hope. I mean,
I think that, you know, it is tough to repeat, but I also feel like they have enough moxie to at least get close enough to give them that a chance.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
They're not a one and done. They're not going to get swept out of the first round.
I don't know.
I doubt. Doubtful.
I hope not. I hope not.
No. Real quick, one of our texters is awesome, 630. His text earlier in the show, we were talking about our new idea for a segment called Swap Meet, where we take another man's junk is another man's treasure. I think I got that horribly wrong.
No, that's right.
It just sounded dirty. It sounded dirty when I said there. But the concept being Chicago iconic junk.
And it has to be Chicago.
Yeah, I think so.
It can't be my old baseball card collection.
Yeah. I think it has to be Chicago. I think it's got to be fun, political, social, like stuff that, you know, like 70s Chicago, 80s Chicago, that kind of stuff that you're willing to part with. And you call in, maybe you text a picture of it to us, and there's a trade with other people. They say, I'll give you my Jane Byrne T-shirt for that. You know, people you bring in one per night, maybe, and you have people call in with what they would give for it.
So the we can arrange somebody to come in who brings the item. You can talk about it, describe it, what have you, and then
we take
the callers can line up and say,
there's no money, but so the transaction or the currency is other Chicago icon stuff. What would you trade for? So, for instance, the 630 texter said, I have this Chicago coloring book I'm willing to trade. And it sent a picture of the very unofficial Jane Byrne coloring book. $3.95. Another picture shows look for your favorite Chicago characters: Richie Daly, Big Jim Thompson, Jesse Jackson, Jay McMullen, Mike Royko, Steve Dahl, Herb Kupcinet, Walter Jacobson. Those are people that are inside the coloring book.
That's amazing,
right?
I was trying to think of something that I have that might be considered iconic Chicago. I think I have maybe 30 A Decade of Stephen Gary cassette tapes. Would somebody want those?
Yeah, see, that's a great start, right? Nobody would. No, I mean, they probably would want that. That's a great. That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. I love this idea.
This is a good idea, and it's not on my. It was from Maggie, my friend Maggie, who threw out. Said she had some stuff, and she's like, "This could be a fun idea." And we kind of went back and forth saying this would be cool. 262 just texted in and said, "You two hockey experts who played the game so much, you know so much about this game now. You're both a joke."
I played.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
I mean,
so take that back, 262. Zimmerman played.
Not on any organized team, but I actually had a ice rink in my backyard.
Yeah, so
automatically. So I know.
This text is disqualified. You know. I love that you and I saying something like, "Well, I just don't know if they've got the firepower." It's like, "You guys don't know nothing. You ain't played." Where that's essentially what news is. If you look at anywhere, like anytime you look at the Sunday nights or the other shows, that's all they do is make predictions about what's going to happen. Why can't we do that?
I mean, obviously I want the Hawks to go win another Stanley Cup. I mean, the city's electric in the summer. The thing is so fun. Around the Chicago. I mean, it's just so fun. I want them to do it. I've been watching the last six or seven games. Which qualifies me as an expert. And I just don't see the drive. I don't see the will. I don't know. Maybe this might get to them and
maybe this will motivate
fire them up.
Right now they're on their way to Winnipeg and they're like, "You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pop up the GN app. See what our station's talking about." And they're like, "Oh, the hockey experts are on." if that's the case, Jonathan, sorry. I'm telling you, man, Swap Meet's got some legs. 815 says, "I had a Chicago Fest button." So there you go. Now you would say, is that enough to get your Jane Byrne coloring book? That's what I'm saying, right? Right off the bat, you're like, "This is great radio." And then there'd be like, we could have some music that's like almost like How to Be a Millionaire or whatever. It's like, dun, dun. Okay, well, let's sweeten the deal.
Well, let me ask Pete. He's a baseball fan. I wonder what Pete would be able to swap out with me for my Dave Kingman cups from Wrigley Field.
Oh.
I've got like three or four of them.
Like cups like that you
like the souvenir cups, and that had Dave Kingman on the side.
Yeah, I'd want those.
Would you give up your Gary Meyer tapes for that? Or your Stephen Gary tapes?
I have like 30 of them, so yeah, I would. You don't, I'd give
one. You give one.
I'll have to see if I can find them. Dave Kingman. Man.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Actually, if I can find them, Pete can just have them.
What?
All right. 630's got another one here. This is great. He's got a flag that was handed out at the Bears 85 Super Bowl game for choreographed fan participation when the halftime was on with Up With People. So it's like a yellow flag, you know, that says Super Bowl 20 on it. And then you're supposed to wave it like when it's like, "Now
time to do it.
Heal the world." That's what I'm saying. This is great. Right?
Yeah, we got to do it.
We got to do it. I one time had a guy was wearing a T-shirt. I think it said, see Richie Run, Run Richie Run or something. It was a 1983 primary T-shirt like for Richie Daly.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it as this kid. It was at a college. And I was like, "Oh, this was a couple years ago." And I'm like, "What do you do? Oh, man, where'd you get that shirt?" And he's like, "Oh, no, man. It's pretty cool. I love it." I'm like, "Do you even know what it is?" And he's like, "No." And I'm like, "I'll give you money right now for it." And we negotiated it down to like, I think it was $15. And I gave him $15 and he gave me the shirt. And it was a small.
So it fit perfectly.
Yeah, so it was like a half shirt for me. So I ended up giving it to my brother. And I was like, "Hey, Josh, it's pretty cool, huh?" And then he's like, "Yeah, he wears it ironically." Like it's not. And then I'm like, "Where's that shirt?" He's like, "Oh, I threw it away or whatever." I'm like, "You know what, man? What are you doing, man?"
Yeah, that's underappreciated.
That's unappreciated. But that's what I'm saying. That's what this could be. This is a great opportunity. We're going to do it soon. Maybe next week.
Swap meet.
I love it. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, stand-up comedian Andy Kindler is coming to Space in Evanston. He's going to be there on April 5th. Kindler is a well-known comedian who can be seen on stage regularly in L.A. and in New York. And on television, all over late-night TV, as well as Mark Maron's friend on IFC's Maron. And he can be heard voicing Mort on the Fox hit Bob's Burgers.
Also, every summer in Montreal, Kindler takes to the Just for Laughs Festival stage to deliver the state of the industry. Andy Kindler, welcome to The Download.
I like everything that was said about me. I agree with it. And it's the kind of thing where I'm almost afraid, how could I top that intro?
It's maybe all facts. It's all facts, man.
I was Beretta on the original Beretta. You don't hear much about Beretta anymore.
You don't. No, you don't.
No.
You don't. For you, how often do you get through Chicago?
I actually get through a decent amount, and I've been coming to Chicago in one form or another since the 90s, although one time I asked the club if it would be all right if I didn't play the Sunday, so they prorated me.
For you, yeah. I mean, you've been able to perform stand-up comedy throughout, you know, like you just mentioned, the 90s up till now. I mean, New York, L.A., all around the country. And you do the state of the industry at the Just for Laughs Festival. I mean, you must see so many changes and pay attention to so many different trends when it comes to performing live on stage in America.
Yeah, I think one of the things is that I give this speech every year in Montreal about what's wrong with comedy. And when I started in the 90s, there was so much wrong with comedy that it was, fun. And now it's harder to find that. I mean, I hate to be the bearer of good news, but I think we have a very good environment and maybe the best environment I've ever seen for comedy. So, like, the clubs I'm coming to, like, I've never been to this place called Space, but I'm noticing when I go on the road that people tend to know what they're going to see. Well, that's one big revolution. When I was in the 90s, you really couldn't go online and see a piece of a comics act. So people didn't know what they were seeing. It'd be, you know, be like telling people, hey, come to the movie theater. But then what movie's playing? You like movies, right? Come on. So I think it's much better. Everything is much better now except for Jimmy Fallon.
It's actually probably the internet helps a comedian develop a following. People like your style, like your voice, and they're going to seek you out as opposed to just going to a comedy club for a night.
Yeah, that's Twitter and social networking in general have been both a revolution and what I assume will kill me, because I end up arguing with people on Twitter. They could be a robot. It could be a software program. It could be an alien arguing with me. And so it's a great place to try it, not just to try and be funny and all these, and try and get promote yourself. And then 4 years later, you realize that you haven't left your house.
Well, there's something to that, because we talk to different comedians who say, you know, you got to have a Twitter profile, you got to have, you know, a YouTube channel, you have to have Facebook, Instagram, you have to get on podcasts. I mean, there seems to be a whole new formula for the way that comedians are approaching success.
Well, it's also generational, and I just like to say things like it's only generational to give the impression that I'm intelligent. Well, it's very generational. You know, but the kids today, I'm so old, I really am old, and I want everybody to know it. But don't feel like when you come out to see me that I'll collapse on stage, because I'm ambulatory and I'm upbeat. But the kids today, a lot of the kids, they grew up very much, they all had video cameras, they all had phones, and they all also, some people are motivated to make short, especially people do more sketch stuff or character stuff, they're more motivated to make short films and stuff like that. I never was like that. Anytime I would do a project that would involve shooting and cameras, it always takes me like a year.
Yeah.
So
right.
It really depends on. So I wouldn't. I probably am not going to have a YouTube channel unless you want. If you're looking for a place with not a lot of programming. But I'm more verbal too. So like I've done jokes on Twitter. Like I did a joke on Twitter that I didn't even know it was a joke really until my nephew said I should do it as a joke, and so it was originally a tweet, and then I put it in the act, and the tweet was I believe it was the great philosopher Descartes who said, I think, therefore am I right, ladies?
Right.
So that's an example of, but then a lot of times tweets don't work out into jokes. But that's I'm more use it for that kind of thing than I have my own YouTube channel. But everything is changing too fast, too. So another problem for me is if you text me and I don't immediately respond, I will never find that text again. It is on the area of my phone stored with a million, you know. So everything's like that. Facebook, I'm frightened of now.
You're frightened.
Yeah, because Facebook, you say something, then everyone gathers underneath the comment. They have an argument. And then the other part of Facebook is everyone telling you what tragedy happened.
Yeah, right. That's you pretty much nailed it. I think that's what Facebook's used for.
And also, like, remember that person I told you about who passed away, my distant relative who you couldn't possibly know? Would you like to see a picture of them in the Navy?
That is true. I think I saw one of those today. I did, yeah.
Then people say to me, my uncle died. I wanted to put a picture of one. I said, okay, I'm not, please. Don't not allow my horrible attitude to affect your experience.
Right. For you, I mean, being an esteemed stand-up comedian, you know, a lot of these younger comedians that come through, 19, 20 years old, they have, like you said, they're different generations, so they're having more success with characters and sketches online, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, all the way down. Do you have to teach them about the work ethic of a stand-up comedian or what it takes to actually put together a good 10, 15-minute set?
Well, that's something. If I was one of these people who walked around yelling, hey, get off my comedy lawn. Yeah. No one would want to be. Right. No one would want to be around me. So I only try and dissuade people when I see, and if they ask me for help, people all the time. And I was like this too when you start out. But at any time, you always have to watch how much is what you're doing worried about how famous you are or whether you're making a living yet, because those are the types of things that will drive you crazy. Anybody who says they don't want to have fame or they don't want to get more popular is lying, unless they're maybe this one person. Everybody wants to get more recognition and more stuff, more ways to make a living. Yeah. But that can't overwhelm what your original reason for getting into comedy was, which is, of course, you like to make people laugh. And I think every time period has its ups and downs. It's like right now, yeah, you can make not vines maybe, but you can make all these different things. But there's also a million people making all these different things. So I had more of an advantage when I started where there were a lot of TV shows on the air I could do that were comedy, and there were a lot of more gigs. But now it's better because you can kind of say whatever you want. Things are much more open. You know, there's different ways of doing things. So it's like there's always positive and negatives. But definitely people should not worry about the externals. If I worry about the externals of my career, I would not be performing today.
Well, you've
been doing it 30 years.
I mean, 30 years. I mean, and one of the ways you made your name, and this is, it's somewhat controversial, is that you're sort of the pioneer of making fun of other comics, making fun of other acts. You mentioned a little bit earlier, Jimmy Fallon, but that was almost a taboo thing when you started, that there was a unwritten rule that you're not supposed to make fun of the people who are before you or the people who are famous at the time doing comedy. What made you cross over that line, and what was the pushback from that?
Well, I don't want to say I was the first person to talk about other comics, but I certainly got addicted to it. I mean, I remember watching George Miller in the 90s go out and say, we just got back from a meeting where we decided that Robin Williams isn't a genius, just merely annoying. Now, of course, I just realized that Robin Williams passed away. So sometimes I bring up painful things.
It's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's an example of...
We get the idea.
There are other comics. I mean, I used to do a lot of jokes about Robin Williams. I have to stop myself because at some points now it's like, you literally are piling on when someone's passed away. But there is this kind of thing like you can make fun of Madonna for hours. You can make fun of Michael Jackson for hours. But if you go against another comic, you're breaking some unwritten code. So I never bought into that code, but I certainly have felt the wrath of the people I've gone after, or at least the fear of seeing them for real. So it just is like something that never should have been a rule, and I don't know that, and I'm not the first comic to break the rule. I mean, I think Chris Rock did it, and he's done that too, but I'm more famous than him. No, I got that wrong. But definitely, and the thing is, like I've been saying about Fallon, if I'm on my deathbed, I don't want the TV on because I don't want my last words to be, can you please turn Jimmy Fallon down? Does everything have to be upbeat, even my death? So a lot of times, like, I'm making a comment, and also sometimes I make comments about people who I used to like, but then I think they went to the dark side. So, I loved Adam Sandler, but then when he started making these series of terrible movies, I started to make fun of him, and he definitely didn't like that.
No. You just gotta...
And Leno, I had to make fun of, because Letterman should have gotten The Tonight Show. Everybody wanted him to get it, and the universe wanted him to get it, and Leno had to stick his chin in.
Well, there's one thing. I mean, it's one thing, because the industry is going to scoff at that, this unwritten rule, or other comedians. But the consumer, the people at home who are watching your set, Andy Kindler's set, they're thinking the same thing. Or they like your, you know, maybe they don't like Jay Leno. Maybe they don't like Jimmy Fallon. But there seems to be more of a connection to the audience at home as opposed to the people on the side of you or your peers in Hollywood.
Right. And you have to – and the thing is, ultimately, I – consider myself a combination of fearless and very fearful. You know, it's like sometimes I'm fearless, sometimes I'm fearful. I don't want anybody not to like me. But the truth is like one time Letterman used to say this when he would do like a, you know, like a mean kind of joke. He would say after, "Oh, I'm sorry, I thought this was a roast." And on a level, yeah, right. On that level, I really am. There really isn't anything personal. I mean, Leno to me is not Trump. I mean, Trump to me is someone who I literally hate and fear could win or something, whereas Leno is just ruining comedy.
Yeah, big. Andy, you know, one thing, you star as Mark Maron's friend on Maron on IFC, and that reminds me of, you know, a lot of the comics that, especially of your generation, that are succeeding right now with their own television shows, Mark Maron, Louis C.K., even what we just saw with Louis C.K. and Zach Galifianakis with Baskets, they're creating a television program that is half comedy, half drama, so I guess dramedy. But there's so much more about the miserable side of comedians. We saw it in the show Louis. We see it a little bit in Maron. Talk about that. I mean, that seems to be where that generation is sort of moving or gravitating to. What's your thought on that?
I think it always reflects the sensibility of the comedian. So, like, to me, Larry Sanders, I mean, there's so many shows that I hold up as, like, brilliant shows. I love Seinfeld, but I also love Larry. And Larry Sanders was a perfect example of, say, what would happen on Baskets, which is, you know, I mean, totally different shows, but there were these moments where they're just uncomfortable real-life moments played out. And I've always, you know, I grew up on Woody Allen movies like Annie Hall in Manhattan and also on Albert Brooks movies. Mm-hmm. So I always loved when the comedy comes out of the relationships. I mean, that's what I think situation comedies that I grew up watching even as a kid, Mary Tyler Moore and all the Bob Newhart, all those shows seemed to be real to me. I mean, I knew they weren't real or All in the Family, but they seemed that the comedy came from reality. And so I think that is a very exciting thing that Zach can do a show like Baskets, and it doesn't have to be – not only doesn't have to be laugh a minute, it really can service what I think Zach does. That's like W.C. Fields or great physical comedians. You really do get laughs from him just from seeing how he physically reacts to things. So I think there's nothing but good news in that, except I don't have a show.
When are we going to get the Andy Kindler show? When's that?
Well, I keep having various different forms of it, but for many years I tried to couch it like Maron would do, but I can't couch it anymore. So it just has to be a show where it's just me and I think mocking TV, and I've made various forms of that, and so far no one's buying it.
Well, we'll buy it at Space in Evanston on April 5th. Andy Kindler's coming to the Chicago area, stand-up comedian, television star, and you can find him at the Just for Laughs Festival every year giving the state of the industry. Andy, thanks for taking some time out to talk to us tonight.
Hey, this was really fun. I had a fantastic time.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock when Patty Vasquez takes over. Coming up after the 10:30 news, Bill Bricky's going to be here, a little live performance from one of the veterans at the Old Town School of Folk Music. Always love Bill, and he'll be here to play some live music and talk about what he's been up to. But right now it's time for Highbrow. This is a regular segment where we focus on the arts here in this great arts and culture town, whether it be the symphony or the opera, or maybe other fine arts like the ballet or the theater. We've got you covered. But Highbrow isn't just, you know, a segment about fine art. I don't know a ton about it, but I love it, and I'm curious about it, and frankly, I'm not that intimidated by it, so why not try to get at one of the best things this great city has to offer, and that's understanding the arts and culture scene. We bring in the segments here and there, and that includes tonight. It's Highbrow.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the American Theater Company, Chicago, has hired a new artistic director. His name, Will Davis. Davis comes from New York City by way of Chicago, and he replaces the late P.J. Paparelli, who died in a car accident back in 2015. Davis has had much success working in New York's off-Broadway theater scene, and he's one of only a handful of transgendered voices working in theater today. The current show on stage, Kill Floor, a show written by playwright Abe Kugler that played to rave reviews at the Lincoln Center back in 2015. This is a bit of a reunion for these two powerful theater professionals as they worked together back on the campus of University of Texas, working on Kugler's first play, Advanced Man. Kill Floor is on stage at ATC Theater through May 1st, and artistic director Will Davis and playwright Abe Kugler are with me tonight. Guys, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Now, this blows my mind that this is not, Will, this is not your season. This is a season that was programmed before you were hired. Talk about that, because you guys have a relationship.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. This season at ATC right now is a legacy season that's been programmed for PJ, as you said. And Kill Floor is a play that PJ really wanted to program along with many, many, many other people in the field. And so it's actually an incredible moment for me to be clocking into my new job at ATC as we are opening Abe's play, Kill Floor. Abe and I go back. We overlapped in grad school at UT Austin, where we worked together on a couple of pieces. Yeah, it's so wonderful to be reunited here in Chicago, and I cannot wait to see the show.
Abe, talk about the feeling of being here in Chicago for the opening and the beginning of Kill Floor. What's it mean to you to see another production of your play?
Oh, man, it's so fantastic. I mean, you know, I hadn't spent any time in Chicago before coming out and meeting PJ initially and then being involved in this production process. And I just love this city. I love the theater scene here. And I think it is really the perfect city in which to do this play. You know, this is a play that's gritty. It's about people working difficult jobs, trying to find ways to retain their hope and their humor and their humanity within really tough circumstances. And I think Chicago gets that story. And to be able to work with the cast that we have up there at American Theater Company has really been a dream come true. And also to have the opportunity, you know, a lot of plays get a first production and then just die. Mm-hmm. So to have the opportunity to keep working on this play and to watch audiences respond to it is really a huge gift for me as a playwright.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to note, that this is a second production. And something that happens, this is, field-wide in the American theater, is that there's a lot of resource and development opportunity and money that is very rightly centered around first productions. But it's actually, the second production is just as important. And is a place where after you've had that first big wild attempt at getting the show up, there's space to tinker and retool and look at what the work is in service of, you know, pushing it out into the field at large.
Abe, how is that? I mean, for you to be able to do a second production or be involved in a second production, different director, the whole bit. Do you find yourself tinkering more with the script, with everything, the production on the second time around?
Well, I think any artist in any field will tell you that you are never finished. So absolutely. You know, there are little line things. There are emotional moments between the characters that I'm fiddling with. There are jokes that I think could land better. So, you know, I'd keep working on this play for another 10 productions if I could, but it's probably good at some point to leave it behind. But it's been a real treat to be able to do that.
Will, do you find it difficult to – I mean, you're the artistic director now, but this play was part of a different artistic director's vision. Do you find it harder to sort of be on the sidelines when you have this relationship with Abe, when you kind of want to step in and say, nah, let's do it this way. Abe, what if we did this way? I mean, is it tougher for you to stay out of that process?
You know, it's not, and I think that is because of my – leadership style and my understanding of what my role is in this particular moment. So I'm the producer. And when I say that, it's important to say that I've been actively working this job for a month and a half. So actually, there are a lot of other folks who are involved in this process. But I will tell you, what was super interesting for me was to go and sit in on a couple of rehearsals. And I'm coming out of 3 years of freelancing. And to sit in those rehearsals as the newly appointed artistic director and suddenly go, oh, I'm that guy. I'm sitting in the corner.
Yeah, right.
I'm sitting in the corner here watching this rehearsal, and I was thinking about, you know, the number of times that I've been in the opposite position.
Where you've seen the artistic director in the corners.
That's right.
A little bit of wine maybe in the
glass. Oh, never. Well, not for me, certainly. But and it was
but now you can
a lot of whispers
now
and
I can,
judging
now I can,
in the corner. Right?
Right, I can sort of wear a funny hat. And well, you know, it was so fascinating sitting there thinking like, okay, great. So how do I want this to go? Like, what do I want this to look like? You know, I am thrilled to be taking over ATC and to leading and thrilled to be leading us into the next chapter. And I'm thinking very seriously about not just what is the art we make, but how are we making it? Mm-hmm. And that breaks down on all levels, including what is my role as the producer? And my role is to be a champion for the artists in the room. And my role is also to help the folks who are in the room make the best play that they are making, not make the play that I am making in my head, you know? So certainly as we move into next season, I'll be directing a couple shows,
okay.
Inviting other folks in also to direct shows. That's how you share, right? You particularly, we have a building and we have the space and the ability to welcome the Chicago community in, and that's forefront on my mind.
American Theater Company's Will Davis, who is the new artistic director, and Abe Kugler, who's the playwright for Kill Floor, which is on stage till May 1st. We'll continue the conversation after this break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Highbrow here on The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests in studio, Will Davis and Abe Kugler. Will Davis, the new artistic director for the American Theater Company, and Abe Kugler, the playwright, Kill Floor, which is on stage until May 1st. Okay, so one of the things that's interesting to me is, obviously with a play, there's so many different dynamics. You've got, you know, the actual play, you've got the directing, all the other thing that's in there. But you know, rehearsals never really talked about. Rehearsal's a big part of putting on a play.
Yes. Oh, my goodness, yes. And Abe can jump in and talk about this as well. You know, as a director, my feeling is that there are sort of two main streams of creative art practice, and one of them is the production, and the other is the way you make it. So I have a lot of very strong views about what I would say, how a director's job is to model the culture of making in the rehearsal room. The way that I go about the artistic process of making a play should be a model for how I'm asking all the other folks and collaborators in the room to enter into that process with me. And the things that are just absolutely must be true in terms of what I'm modeling is a sense of adventure and a commitment to staying curious and being patient. So when something falls apart, instead of saying, oh my God, what are we going to do? And having sort of like a reactive response to that. For me, the question is, oh, this thing fell apart. How curious? How curious? What does that mean we should do? You know, how should we move forward from that? And keeping, as you're saying, keeping out of the room a sense of that's right and that's wrong.
That's interesting because that's going to be your – that as an artistic director, I mean, the things that, mm-hmm. you know, things that go wrong are past the play. I mean, there are going to be things about funding.
Yeah.
There's going to be things about
marketing.
So, I mean, taking that philosophy past just the rehearsal room to the actual, you know, business side of a theater company.
Yeah.
The same idea, right?
And I'm in this moment right now where it's a very important part of my job as I'm entering into my tenure at ATC to be on a really rigorous fact-finding mission, to be looking at how has this company been running, what's working, what's not, and taking a minute to get my arms around the entire institution before I come in guns a-blazing, because that's not actually going to get us where I want us to be. I have incredibly big ambitions for the company and for our footprint in Chicago and what we're going to be able to do nationally, and I actually think that Kill Floor is a prime example of the kind of work that I want us to continue to produce and the relationships I want us to continue to have with writers who are at the forefront of the field, and also the fact that this is a second production that's coming to us from its Lincoln Center debut, mm-hmm. that's an important example of something that ATC has done in the past and will continue to do more.
Abe, let me ask you about the rehearsal room, mm-hmm. Rehearsing a play, the collaboration with not just the director, there's going to be more collaboration with a playwright and a director in the text, but the relationship with the actors. I mean, is it, you know, what I think about is I don't know much about television production, but the writers are usually, when the project's done,
get out of the way and let the actors do their thing. Is it similar in theater, or are you more collaborative in the way that you
interact with them? Well, it's a balancing act. I think the playwright's job is to figure out when to speak up and when to shut up. And that's a hard balance to find. There are times in the rehearsal room where I'm spouting off with my opinions and the director's sort of giving me side eye. And I realize that I've actually screwed with something, which is that the actor is at a certain point in their process and they're trying to figure out who this character is and they're trying to figure out their own version of this character in their head. And the funny thing about being a playwright as opposed to, you know, a novelist or a painter is that you're creating a blueprint that other people then apply their creativity to. And that means two things. First of all, that you discover fantastic things that you didn't think were in the script or didn't know. And second of all, you got to learn how to give up control.
Right, right.
And sometimes that means there'll be...
you have an idea in your head of what it is, and you may see an actor make a choice that, everybody in the room loves, and you're like, that's not what I was thinking.
Totally. And sometimes I'm right, and sometimes I'm so wrong. And it takes a week of watching the play and cursing under my breath before I'm like, oh, man, someone other than me was right in the room.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, something I say when I teach is that you should let an idea be as wrong as possible for as long as possible. It's part of that, but it's also part of this delicate balance of those of us on the creative team, so like the playwright and the director, having the patience to let an actor work through a choice that we have in the back of our minds as being like not where we want to end ultimately, but giving the lion's share of that creative process to the actor so that they can sit and grapple with that choice and either suddenly turn around and say to the director and the writer, you know what, I need to try something else, or say, help, or say, is this working? But, you know, that you leave that space for them, which can feel agonizing, you know?
Let me ask you, Will, you know, in one of the interviews you did when you came to town, I think it was with Chris Jones, you said in the piece, you know, don't expect, I'm paraphrasing, but don't expect talking heads kind of theater, that you bring a more physical approach to the stage. What does that mean for ATC?
Sure. Well, one thing it makes me think of immediately is the show that Abe and I made together in grad school, which is a prime example of what I'm talking about. I come to the theater through dance. So my first lens in on a piece is not just the analysis of the words on the page, but the analysis of its movement. I like to think one of the first questions I ask a play is, what is its velocity? And I mean that definitively. What is its rate of change over time? And how does that live in the body, live in space, live in the way we are thinking about time on stage? And those three things, time, space, and the body, then get put into dialogue with the written word. Mm. And that is how I think about a play that needs the theater. And that's maybe the less esoteric way to talk about this, is that projects I'm interested in are projects that need the theater. They need that liveness, that manipulation of time and space and the body to have their greatest impact. When I said that thing, when I said I don't do talking heads, what I mean is that plays where for 2 hours you watch two people sort of bat a question or an argument back and forth that has sort of a topical kind of issue heft to it and drive to it are less interesting to me. Plays that use the theater as a space to ask impossible questions. I'm thinking of Advance Man, this play we made Abe and I made together in grad school, where there's something that's been put on the page from the playwright that's a proposal for something impossible, like he flies, like we're in a boat on a river, you know, whatever that may be, that those questions that actually seem like they're not the purview of the theater, those are the ones where when you figure out how to answer it on stage, you'll never forget
That's the secret. I mean, that's the secret and magic of theater, being able to take people's idea or even their preconceived notions of what it is and be able to creatively put it on stage.
Yeah, and you know, it shows up. I'm thinking about John Barry's direction of Killfloor, which I can only speak to a little bit because I've been in the room only a small amount of time. But I think it shows up in a number of different ways. You know, there's the spectacle version of this, and then I think, you know, something that John has done so beautifully in this production of Abe's Killfloor is thought about how the movement of objects can speak to the overall sense and feel and texture and taste of the play, of the sort of like bigger emotional ephemera of the play.
Right. So in this case, because the play concerns a kill floor, with a lot of heavy moving parts. I think, a kill floor is a very fast-moving environment where workers are, you got big pieces of meat flying at you every few seconds. So the movement of the scenery on and off the stage in John's staging, which I think is so exciting, happens very quickly. I think it's a play that's, you won't be bored in this play, because the second a scene ends, boom, you've got something coming at the actors from off stage. And that's really exciting to me. That's an interpretation I haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm. Well, the play is Kill Floor. It's on stage at ATC, the theater here in Chicago, until May 1st. Abe Kugler's the playwright. Will Davis is the artistic director, the new artistic director at ATC. You got to come back. I'd love to have you back because I want to talk about your season when it comes out.
I'd love that.
You're in now, but you're kind of in both places, New York and Chicago, but you'll be back or here full time coming up in the fall.
Yep.
Thanks to both of you for coming in and
so
talking tonight.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. I'm really bummed that I'm happy that there's a Blackhawks game because it's always great to have the Blackhawks on. But I'm bummed that we are not on the air on April Fool's Day.
I know.
One of my faves. My first broadcast here at WGN was April Fool's Day.
It was.
We jumped in 2 weeks prior than my actual launch, or maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and did a fake Cubs broadcast.
Yeah.
Where we faked that there was a game that night, even though there wasn't.
And, hilarious.
It was pretty good. I did a good live ball, play-by-play.
Yeah, you did.
All right. Ball two. And the key is a lot of pausing.
I was I was listening. I was working for another shop at the time. So what was it like? What were people saying? Were you getting texts? Were people, did they not understand? Did people get in on the joke? Or what was happening back here?
It's interesting because I'm more attuned now to texting, because people text in and I've got the systems down. So I wasn't, at the time.
You weren't really sure what was.
Well, I was also sitting in the other chair. There was an engineer. So now I run the board here. So it's just different. So I was just sitting in that chair. So I didn't necessarily have it. Most people were like, this sucks. Or I thought the Cubs weren't on anymore, so we did dupe them a little bit. And then there were a couple more. I mean, the variation was, this is funny, this sucks. What happened to Gary Meyer? That's the...
So nothing has changed in the year that we've been on.
I've done a lot of really fun April Fool's radio in my time. I did a call-in at a different radio station where we had a couple improvisers who've been on the show do a bit where they were they had a service. It was a chef, and he had a service that when your pet died, he would prepare the pet in a four-course, like a fine dining cuisine.
As one final tribute.
Yeah, as one final tribute.
Yeah.
Needless to say, the calls on that one were huge. And it was really fun because they really, really, really hated that one. That the calls were fast and furious, and they would call up to be mad, and then the chef would be like, I understand. But, we would definitely take precaution. We would saute. Like, it's just really, really good. And for months after the fact, people would call the radio station and be like, I heard this segment about cooking your own pets, and be like, it's an April Fool's joke. It was an April Fool's joke. And there'd be a pause, and they go, well, I just think that is a terrible, like, they wouldn't
accept it.
They
hear what they want, yeah.
Another one we did was a fake, how XRT does the live broadcast from the Cubs from Wrigley Field?
Yeah.
We faked that we were at Yahtzee's. Mm-hmm. And, I was working for NPR at the time, so it was a big shock that we were doing a live show from Yahtzee's. But I got 15 or 20 Second City performers to help me, and we acted like there was a live audience, and we acted like there was with different people played different roles. It was really, really fun and it was good. There was a lot of ambience. We put track under the whole thing, like it was just a bar.
Noise, yeah.
It was really fun. It was funny. Hijinks. That's what we called it. Live from Hijinks.
What do you? I. I feel like now with social media and whatnot, it's harder to trick people. Because people are on Twitter and on Facebook and they're talking about it, whereas in the old days, you didn't have that. Right. And
you didn't know April Fool's Day was coming necessarily. But now it's just like,
yeah.
But radio's that one thing where you tune in and you kind of forget. So, for instance, last night, I mean, great example, we had our number one Donald Trump supporter, Mark Sievers, who is Connor O'Malley, who's a writer in New York. He writes for the Seth Meyers Show. So it's this great character where he plays this, you know, Trumper. And last night I even set it up. I mean, you were here. I set it up like five times. This is character flaws. We're going to have sketch and improv, and including this guy. And the text that came in, I mean, there were a lot. There were a lot and that were like, how dare you have this guy get this idiot off the air. He doesn't know what he's talking about. A lot of that stuff where you're like, well, that was the joke.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that they're still with radio because you're going along with, I mean, whenever Kate does the drunk Cubs fan, people call in really angry that we put a drunk person on the line, that she doesn't know what she's talking about. She doesn't represent the Cubs. And then, you know, we have to remind them that it's a fake character.
And I guess with radio, especially with people driving, they're getting in their car at a different time, they're tuning in at different times, so they may, you know, they're not perhaps listening at the top of the hour all the time.
Right,
they're tuning in, so they're just hearing what's going on without really knowing what the joke is yet. So, yeah, I guess it works. So,
yeah. I mean, the original April Fool's thing that we did was the drunk Cubs fan. We did it on video. We did a video. And we put it out, and we were like, oh, hey, it's Colleen Henneman. We're outside of Wrigley Field on opening day. But it was April Fool's Day. It was like an April Fool's opening day. And really, really interesting, the response we got for that video went viral, everything, and that kind of launched Colleen Henneman. All right, we're going to take a break. We come back. Bill Bricky live in studio. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Patty Vasquez, pretty late with Patty Vasquez, takes over at that time. Well, if you're heading out this weekend, might I suggest stopping by the Hidden Shamrock on North Halsted? The Lincoln Park venue is one of the oldest music venues in Chicago, but don't go for the ambiance. Go for the music. Longtime Chicago musician and Old Town School of Folk Music stalwart Bill Bricky will be there on Saturday with his band BLT. That stands for Bill Bricky, Steve Levitt, and Jimmy Tomasello. Bill Bricky's in studio with me, and he brought his guitar. Bill, pleasure to see you. It's been a while.
Hey, Justin. It's been a couple days.
So I say stalwart. I mean, today is a perfect example of your life. I mean, you taught all day at the Old Town.
All day. Yeah, started at 10 o'clock, taught until 1. Took a little break in the middle of the day, started back at 5:30.
What are you teaching over there?
In the morning, I teach children, you know, like 3-month-old to, 2 years.
Just finger picking? Teach them to finger pick?
No, we're just singing with moms and babies, you know. Boom, boom, boom. Good morning. Good morning. How are you today? Right? We do lullabies and children's songs. Then I come back and I do adult classes, guitar level 1. Soul ensemble tonight. We were rocking out the good stuff. We did some Michael Jackson tonight.
How long have you been over there now? When you and I were just talking about riding the train together in 2001.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, how long have you been teaching at the Old Town now?
I've been there 26 years.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my follow-up question is, how many bands are you currently in?
I was trying to think of that. I think I'm going to have to say 4. You know, I have Come Sunday, which just a couple of years ago, we just finished touring Columbia. Mm-hmm. We did a 2-week tour down there. That was amazing. BLT, which I've been in for 15 or so years, probably longer. Then I have my own band, Woodbone and Steel. And that's Graham Nelson and Michael Taylor. I got to get a shout out to them. And I also have another band called Count the Days, which is kind of an on-again, off-again thing. And then also I have a solo act as an adult and then solo act as a children's artist. So I have a new children's CD coming out sometime within the next couple of months. And after that, I'll be working with, you know, the great and magnificent, he'll probably hate that I said that, Steve Dawson on an adult album. So it's... You know,
look at you.
It's a hustle.
Bill Bricky, all right, you want to perform something before? Let's do yeah. a song so we can get that in, and then I want to ask you about what you've been up to. So, Bill Bricky, what are we going to hear?
We're going to hear a song called, God, what is the name of this song? Why can't I remember it? Oh, it's called King's New Clothes.
King's New Clothes. Bill Bricky, right. BLT, is going to be at the Hidden Shamrock on Saturday night. Take it away, Bill.
This is the way that she gets, you know, red, white, and blue from his fist, you know. But you better not say that. You better not say that it's so. You better not say that. You better not say that it's so. She's not bleeding, she's just trying out the king's brand new clothes. These are the words that he says, you know. And you best believe, 'cause he's degreed, you know. But you better not say that. You better not say that it's so. You better not say that. Oh no, you better not say that it's so. Not lying, he's just trying out the king's brand new clothes. You better not say that. You better not say that it's so. You better not say that. Oh no, you better not say that it's so. There's no worries, just the king's brand new clothes. This is the life that we get, you know. Homeless and poor on the street, you know. But you better not say that. You better not say that it's so. You better not say that. Well, no, you better not say that it's so. There's no worries, just the king's brand new clothes. The king's brand new clothes. One more time, you know he said that. The king's brand new clothes. Oh yes, Lord, you best believe that. The king's brand new clothes. Whoa, yeah, yeah, yeah. The king's brand new.
Bill Bricky in studio here on the download, live on Michigan Avenue in our Allstate Studio Showcase studio here. Bill is going to be performing with his band BLT. That's Bill Bricky, Steve Levitt, and Jimmy Tomasello. They're going to be at right. the Hidden Shamrock up on North Halsted. It's like Diversey and Halsted. It's been Diversey there forever. Halsted, right. How often do you get, you're obviously at the Old Town, you're teaching. Are you pretty much playing live every weekend? What's your schedule like as a working musician in Chicago?
As a working musician in Chicago, we're really fortunate in Chicago. There's a lot of venues, and you know that's something Chicago should never stop patting itself on the back about. We have good support from bar owners, club owners, people in coffee houses, and things like that, and. We don't have to do the pay for play game mm-hmm. that they do out in Los Angeles. We have a strong community, like radio show hosts like yourself. I was just on WLUW And we have a really strong community of musicians, you know, really strong creative folks. Robbie Folks is back.
Yeah.
He's playing with almost, you know, anybody who's like really dedicated. He tries to hook up with them. He's doing a regular thing out there at the Hideout. You know, it's being a working musician in Chicago. You can do some stuff, you know. I'm not going to say that you don't have to have a day gig, but you can do a lot more than you can do elsewhere. And I think that it shows up in the bands that have come out of this town, you know. And that's ever since, you know, the Great Migration from the Deep South up to Chicago, which I can go on and on and on about. But life as a musician in Chicago is really good.
Well, we gotta get you back on because, you know, when we were setting this up, you're like, I'm really getting into protest music. You're talking about rediscovering
and, Yeah.
And playing protest music, and I want to talk about that with you. Well, just got to come back.
Yeah, you know, I would love to come back.
You got one more in you? You got another song?
I think I got one. let me think.
You just want to do one of the toddler songs?
It's too late for toddlers. That's they're all in bed.
All right, what is this one?
This one is called, this is kind of a protest song. It's got a little bitty protest piece in it. It's called Let the Rain Fall.
Let the Rain Fall, Bill Bricky. Yeah.
Some folk find their peace in silence. Me, I just go on and on. Some folk find their love in violence. Me, I just sing my song. I hope the Lord don't mind it if I get a little angry sometimes. Hope the Lord don't mind it if I say sometimes it blows my mind. Hope the Lord don't mind it when I say I get a little bit more weary each day. I hope the Lord don't mind that I let the rain fall down. Let the rain fall down. Let the rain fall down. Let the rain fall down, down, down. Now some folk walk up on the water. Me, I'm an ordinary man. I get my peace like Bush's daughters, though I try not to when I can. I hope the Lord don't mind that I get a little angry sometimes. I hope the Lord don't mind that I say sometimes this life blows my mind. I hope the Lord don't mind it when I say I get a little bit more weary each day. I hope the Lord don't mind that I let the rain fall down. Let the rain fall down. Let the rain fall down. Let the rain fall down, down, down. Now some folk call me sentimental. Me, I'm a thousand crazy minds. I try to do things like I'm meant to, but I got anger on my mind. I hope the Lord don't mind that I get a little shaky sometimes. I hope the Lord don't mind that I say sometimes this life blows my mind. I hope the Lord don't mind.
I hope the Lord don't mind that I let the rain fall down. Let the rain fall down. Let the rain fall down. Let the rain fall down, 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 down. Let the rain fall.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, Bill Bricky. Bill Bricky and his band BLT, that stands for Bill Bricky, Steve Levitt, and Jimmy Tomasello, are going to be at the Hidden Shamrock this Saturday up on North Halsted. Bill, always a pleasure to see you, man. Thanks for I mean, we could do this all night. You got to come back.
Yeah.
We got to talk protests.
No, no,
all right.
Definitely want to be back.
We'll come back. Thanks all for right. being here, man.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, that's going to do it tonight for me. Patty Vasquez is up next. Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Tomorrow the Blackhawks are on, so we are off. Have a great weekend, and I'll talk with you on Monday.